You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. We're joined today by Dr. Doug Ronald, who's an academic and author of two previous books, Young Nelsons, Boy Soldiers During the Napoleonic Wars, which came out in 2009, and Youth, Heroism, and War Propaganda, Britain and the Young Maritime Hero, 1754-1820, which came out in 2015. Prior to becoming an academic and full-time writer, he ran his own company as an investment banker in the city of London. But now he's a full-time writer with his latest book, which came out earlier this year, is The Life of John Andre, the Redcoat Who Turned Benedict Arnold. So welcome, Doug. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at Spycast.
And thank you for giving me the opportunity. Absolutely.
Well, this book's been out for a little while, and we've been trying to schedule you, and as they might be able to hear you, you're not from Washington, D.C., so it's been kind of this constant back and forth with the publisher about when are you going to be in town, so we're really happy that you're here now. The question I've had since I read this book, and I came back to it lately because I wanted to make sure I remembered everything, but the thing that really stood out to me is I've read other biographies of John Andre, or John Andre as a historical figure has popped up in other works, whether it was about the Culper Spy Ring or about just the revolution in general.
Yeah.
But what makes now the time to write a new John Andre biography? And what really makes this book different than the books that have come before it?
Yeah, I mean, I came across John through my research for my doctorate, where I was looking at young heroes, and I've been taught American history, the 13 reasons why we lost the Revolutionary War, we the Brits, okay, you won. So I wasn't looking to rewrite history, but I wanted to learn more about that war, albeit from a painful process possibly. But I came across John, and he caught my eye because he was described in the British press, and I was studying war propaganda, as a British hero. And I said to myself, wait a minute, we had no heroes. It was all one-way traffic.
Right.
We lost, we lost, we lost. So that caught my eye, and I started reading back, and I went to one of the earliest ones, Winthrop Sargent's, a very good early biography. And I went through the process, and obviously there was a learning curve for me, but I noticed it was written very much from naturally from an American point of view, as were the subsequent biographies. That was the first issue for me. But secondly, yes, he came across as a hero, but he also came as a hero not just for Britons, but also for Americans. Mm-hmm. They took him to their heart. And if I was going to write a book about a war we lost, I didn't want to go looking for a bad Brit.
Right.
Okay? Because I knew nobody was going to read about a bad Brit. Okay? But Americans are taken to their heart, not least Alexander Hamilton.
Sure, yeah. Well, I mean, exactly. Even modern ones. I mean, we look at this. I can tell you my perception of Andre is kind of as this dashing, you know, British officer who got a bad beat, and we'll talk about that at the end.
Yeah.
But also somebody who was a professional. And it's very hard to be mad at anybody, even if they're part of the enemy, if they're a professional, right? I mean, you look at, you know, even the way we perceive World War II in the German army, right? We don't, Rommel is, you know, kind of considered
a great general, even in the West, even in the non-Hitler side, because he was a professional soldier.
Yeah.
And I see Andre as kind of this professional soldier, where Cornwallis and Clinton and others had politics on their mind, and they were somewhat less of a kind of high-level professional soldier. Andre was a soldier first and foremost. I guess that the idea of honor really brings him out to the Americans, certainly from my perspective.
Yeah, and going a stage further on that, what I noticed in reading, and here was possibly a prejudice issue, that yes, he was a professional soldier, but when it came to spying, he came across to Americans, or he was portrayed by American writers, as a bit of an amateur, mm-hmm. a bit of a naive, because when you get caught,
right.
somebody's at fault, okay? So it has to be the guy who gets caught. And I started to question that. Because I wasn't sure, but I wanted to find out. So I thought I should go back to the beginning of his story, okay? And in negotiating with my publisher over what the title would be, it was originally John Andre. I said, no, this is going to be the life of John Andre. Mm. His debacle at the end, his demise at the end is part of a journey. He didn't want to end up at that journey, but I needed to understand how the journey started.
Right.
So that meant going back, and typically a lot of the previous biographies were, say, 300 pages long, typical size biography, 250 pages about the moment he arrived in America in 1774, right. So maybe 50-odd pages about what happened before he actually got to America. Well, he got to America at the age of 24, died at the age of 30. So yes, for Americans it's important to understand those 6 years because they can dovetail it into the whole story of the war. But I needed to understand how he'd come there. Was it by accident? Did he hate the Americans? Was he looking for a punch-up? You know, where was he after?
Right.
And I needed to understand that. And as a result of that process, as I embarked on the story, I found loads of new material that hadn't appeared in early biographies about
those. Well, the crazy part is that, like, there's huge gaps in the historical record about what Andre did.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of these where a lot of the history is just kind of the exciting parts, and there's a lot of gaps in between.
Yeah.
How did you fill those gaps in many respects? I mean, you said you found stuff, but you also say in the book, in your acknowledgments, you had a magic bullet in the fact that the Andre family itself helped you to fill some of those gaps.
Exactly. And there I have to thank my wife. She went on Ancestry.com. I'm not doing a plug here for Ancestry.com, yeah. But they're a very good organization. And she put me in touch with a young descendant, I think he started in Australia. And she had been managing the Andre websites and put me in touch with an uncle, one in England and another uncle in Australia. The uncle in Australia had photograph material, original paintings, but the one in England in deepest, darkest Sussex, just south of London, had the metal chest full of letters.
Oh yeah,
and memorabilia.
Yeah,
and
that's a dream for a historian, right?
Exactly.
Is the dusty chest in the attic somewhere that no one's ever seen.
Exactly. And you know, literally, he had to, you know, he fished it out for me just as I arrived, so he hadn't prepared for my visit. Okay, and we fished out the box. It was a metal box. Opened it, come, and you know, the dust all falls off everywhere. And I started sifting through it, and he offered me to take it away. And I said, if I take it away, because I come along with a notebook and I was going to note down like this. He said, no, take it away. And I said, well, if we're going to do that, I'm going to have to take a record.
Right.
You're going to have a copy of what I'm taking away, and I'll have a copy, and we'll sign off on that. Because I'd read a story recently where somebody did exactly the same, walked off with the material, and when he brought it back 3 weeks later, it was shy of X number of documents, which were then sold online. And, you know, that's I'm a professional historian. So, you know, we had a record, but I took my stuff back that he'd given to me to lend, to look at, back down to the West Country where I live, in rural England, and with my 23 sheep, and my
Seriously,
wife and two dogs.
Sheep?
Yes, exactly, yes.
Okay, so you have a writing area out
exactly.
there where no
so
one's going to bother you.
The sheep are my antidote to the serious writing. I write in the morning, and then I go and talk to the sheep in the afternoon.
Okay,
so you've got your image there. But anyway, so I'm back home, and he rings me, the Major Andre. He is also Major Andre, of obviously a later generation. Anyway, he calls me and said, I'm going to be down in your area. Can I drop in? And it became clear to me that somebody in the family had said, how could you have handed over all those documents? Okay.
Right. Well, I mean, that's natural. Like, you did what?
Exactly. Yeah, you know, and probably because they'd read that story. And that's why I'd made sure with the major that we were, you know, we were open and honest with each other. So he came down, had lunch with us, and I handed back the documents, having, quote unquote, photocopied or recorded what I needed to do. But I had the letters now.
Right.
And various other documents he gave me as well. And that sort of kick-started things. But a lot of the other material I came across was, frankly, online. Now, partly because John Andre has been such a popular figure, but also because he was in the newspapers at the time, how could he end up in Westminster Abbey?
Right.
You know, buried there as a British hero. Okay. So you know, there are lots of threads there, but I found that by keywording for him, I could find him in all sorts of interesting places online. The problem is, how do you spell John Andre? John's easy, but the Andre is spelled variously depending on who your author is. A-N-D-R-E with an accent, or A-N-D-R-E double E,
right.
Or I-E.
And didn't his family call him Jean, basically, spell it J-A-N?
Jean, yeah, exactly, yeah. Because they were French origin.
Right.
And they were what you called Huguenots, right. what we called Huguenots, divided by a common language.
Yeah.
They'd fled France as Protestants, exiled, thrown out of France, which was going back to being pure Catholic. And they came over in the 1740s, John's parents. John was born in 1750, first born in the family, but also in England with the family. And but there was a merchant family, a very successful family, first in France, then in Geneva, and now building up a career in Britain, trading primarily in fine silks and fine cloths. So again, question. Why would John, who's being groomed for life in the merchant business, suddenly go off into the army? Okay, when you're the second son of Lord so-and-so, yes, you go into the army, and third son, you go into the clergy. But a merchant, he was being groomed. His whole education was geared to that.
And it was really good education. I mean, he had like the cream of the crop education, yeah. Groomed to be an English gentleman, you know, to make a ton of money.
Exactly, and mixing with Lord so-and-so. What I discovered was in 1769, life changed for the family. The family had been chasing money on, effectively, it's a very small stock market we had there, in a company called the East India Company, which I'm sure you've heard of it, okay, which was being ramped up on the stock market. I use that vernacular because obviously I come from the stock, the world of business. And it was being ramped up, and the family bought into that heavily, borrowed heavily to finance it. And the news came back from India that was bad news, and the shares tanked, fell dramatically. And overnight, the family was, I wouldn't say bankrupted, but was severely impaired financially.
Like close to bankrupt.
Which coincided with the father suddenly dying.
Yeah, you say coincided. There's no coincidence involved.
Exactly.
In this, probably, right? He killed himself.
That's my view.
Yeah.
Okay, but you know, I couldn't say that for certain. But it was obviously created a tragedy within the family, both from a business point of view, but also from a personal point of view. And John suddenly found himself head of the family, which was not only of his mother, but of three daughters who were reaching marriageable age, and now were no longer marriageable because they're financially impaired.
Right, and this is still a time when there's dowries involved. There's still a time when you're marrying for status.
Yeah.
And Andre, you said this is 69, so Andre is only 19 at this point.
Exactly.
So it's not like he's kind of in that in-between stage of schooling being over, but his life really hasn't begun yet.
Exactly, yeah. And suddenly he has to start taking life very seriously. And he's in a relationship, not a relationship, that's the wrong word, a friendship with a poet called Anna Seward, which diverts him away. That marriage has she's lining him up to marry an adopted sister called Honora Snaid. Okay. But with the impairment of their financial situation, that's had to be called off. So John suddenly finds himself not only head of the family, financially impaired, but his plans for marriage are torpedoed.
And the way you've written it, this wasn't just, yes, it was set up for kind of a status marriage. There seemed to be considerable feelings involved in this as well, at least toward
Anna, exactly. Right?
But that falls through also. I mean, so basically, his father kills himself. His family now is broke.
Yeah.
The kind of quasi-love of his life has told him to kind of go away.
Yep.
And now he has got a whole family to take care of. I mean, this is about as crisis as it gets.
Yeah. I think none of us would want that on ourselves, okay? You know, it's so from his point of view, he took the bit in his teeth and said to himself, okay, I've got to get on with my life. And there's still a place for me in the merchant company, the family business, but I've got to move on from here because I've got high ambition. So there were other relatives who were already in the army as redcoats, and so he was able to get by himself a commission. He'd inherited something from his father's will, so he decided he was going to buy a commission in the army with intention to basically serve and fight on the continent.
Right.
He was fluent in French, so that was a starting point, because the typical traditional enemy for Britain was France. So if we were going to do any work on the continent, it was going to be fighting the French. But our natural allies were the Germans.
Right.
So he went over to Germany to complete his training. He was sent over by his commanding officer. Again, this was a character that had not appeared in earlier books about John. Colonel Prescott, important to Americans because he was the one who mistreated, according to Americans, Ethan Allen.
Right.
Okay.
Allen, who was not really an American officer, was kind of on its own.
Exactly. Exactly.
Vermont boys.
Absolutely.
And it became this rallying cry.
This was the twilight zone before Washington had made sure that the army was no longer a rebel army, but it was a continental army. But the British officer was still treating anybody who was the enemy as a rebel, including Prescott against Ethan Allen. And he became the subject of a lot of war propaganda against Prescott because he was a typical red coat officer, in a sense, overplaying his hand with the enemy. So, but he spotted John as a special character in that he not only spoke French, and now would speak German, but also had that special edge. That's firstly an ambition, and a lot of officers who went in as redcoats, who frankly didn't have ambition, they'd just been kicked into it by the family, just go out there and wear a redcoat for a few years, and you'll become a general and so on and so forth. So John was special,
he especially went to the best schools. He was very good looking. He was obviously very smart. He had a kind of a creative, independent streak in him that wouldn't necessarily be true of everyone else.
Yeah,
like you mentioned. Let me stop you real quick because. Yep. What I had to kind of keep telling myself, and I certainly know this, but a lot of Americans may not even think about it, was the fact, in hindsight, we think in the 1770s, Britain's entire focus was on the United States and the revolution coming, and, you know, the Boston Tea Party and the Boston Massacre. But it wasn't until really a couple of years later than that, even the early 1770s, the expectation was the next war was going to take place against France. Or on the continent, you know, that was the primary focus. Like, we were kind of the secondary. We, the United States, was kind of the secondary theater of operations, or at least people expecting that, you know, by the early 1770s.
Not least because back up 10 years to what you call the French and Indian War, and we call the Seven Years' War, it ended for you in 1761, but for us it ended in 1763. We had been blood brothers fighting alongside with American officers and juniors against the French and against the Indians on your continent. So intuitively, we saw Americans as our friends, our allies, because you were Protestant, we were Protestant. The natural enemy back in those days was the Catholics, and they were Spain and they were France. So we didn't need to take, and this was our fatal flaw, if one's looking to the politics of leading up to the war, it was Britain's fatal flaw. They didn't understand that what they were doing to the American colonies was so offensive to the Americans. And we had this sort of casual attitude to realpolitik and politics vis-a-vis the 13 colonies, because surely the Americans understand that the real enemy is France, Spain, etc., etc.
Because there were uprisings inside England, there were uprisings in the broader British Isles within Ireland, there were uprisings in British held territories on the continent. Certainly there were uprisings in the colonies, and they weren't seen as anything dramatically different.
Yeah.
you know, from what was happening other places within the empire.
Exactly. That's what I tried to say this in my book, where for me, the journey for someone like John Andre and his colleagues was, it went from riot to rebellion to revolution. Okay? And it moved pretty rapidly,
right,
you know, step by step. But somebody like John arrived in 1774 thinking his job was to put down a riot, just like he'd put down riots of tinners down in Cornwall a couple of years before. You called in the you called in the army when the civilian governor or the local civilian official, magistrate, asked you to come in. The army was not there to put down riots. It had to be called in to put down riots when the local police or militia, in this case, had failed to do the job. So that's what he thought he was doing, not coming to fight a war or anything like that. So, you know, events were moving, as we all know, pretty rapidly. But he arrived, and I think this is an important point I found, because again, in looking at earlier biographies, there's an element of John was a bit of a naive. And what I tried to understand was that he arrived in 1774, not armed with a full knowledge of what he was up against in America or going to be up against, but he came fully armed with the understanding of this notion of petite guerre,
right,
small warfare. The secret warfare that sort of surrounds the big battles, how you get there and how you come away from there. And his job, as what he'd been trained for during his time in Germany, when he was at Göttingen University and studying, was not only learning the language, but learning how to make friends in the 300 German states that could or could not be British allies against France in the next war, to make those friends so they would be useful as effectively a fifth column,
right,
of information and source and relationships when the British army came back 10 or 15 years later for the next war.
Right. So he's basically developing his tradecraft. He's,
yep,
developing how to become a good intelligence officer.
Yep.
He's trained militarily how to become a special forces guy, a commando.
Yep.
And what I thought was really interesting and what really jumped out to me about his personality was when he went to Canada before he went to the United States. And unlike everyone else in his unit, he went to the Native Americans and said, teach me how to fight like you guys do.
Yep.
Which, again, the 1770s, a British redcoat, an officer, you can't imagine anyone deciding.
Unheard of.
Yeah.
You're absolutely spot on. It's fascinating because, you know, I saw this letter and I read it, and it's written to one of his sisters, his eldest sister. And I'm reading it. So that's a piece of, you know, useful, you know, local colour, you know, a bit of tourism stuff here. And I read behind the words, and I said, he may not be saying it to her, but he's saying it to himself. What I've just done now is learned how to fight effectively guerrilla warfare, local style.
Yeah.
Be it in the snow or not in the snow. This is stuff that had been learned actually during the French and Indian War, okay, but now had to be relearned by the new generation. And he arrived out there trained by Prescott to fight this bush fight, is what it was called. And he suddenly found himself learning it so he could teach his fellow officers, because they were just been sitting around for the last year or so.
Right.
Okay.
Well, and they had no intention of going out and asking Native Americans to teach them how to do it, right?
Exactly.
They were too British, I guess, at the time. They were,
yeah,
too, you know.
Yeah, we know everything.
Right. Well, and that certainly comes in handy later on. I mean, that's he becomes, you know, kind of today where we look at the hybridization of special operations and intelligence. You know, this is something in the 1770s, he already realized that this idea of what happens on the outskirts of war was this combination of being having human intelligence officers on the ground giving you information, but at the same time, covert action and special operations kind of coming together.
Exactly. But the extra ingredient he learned or brought to the imminent war and was already displaying during that brief time that he was in Canada before he was captured at Fort St. John in 1775 was that women who are normally invisible in war, muted in war, are important in war because they're at home, they bring relationships, information, sources, all the material that could be useful to, in this case, the enemy, to the Britons. And so he's out, he's befriending the French-Canadian women. How could he do that? Because he was, among other things, devilishly good-looking.
Right. And suave, okay. And he had
exactly.
Education, and he spoke fluent French.
Yeah.
because of his background.
Exactly. Yeah. And he was used to relating to women.
Right.
Carry on. Then.
No, I mean, that's he uses that for the rest of his career.
Exactly. We'll come on to that when we get to the plot.
Well, but even before the plot, when he's a POW, I'm using that term loosely, of obviously they don't call him that at the time, for about a year, right? Yeah. He's in prisoner camp, where he's still kind of wheeling and dealing and kind of developing leads and developing relationships, even as a prisoner of the Americans.
Exactly. And it's interesting that the, you know, a lot of previous biographers tend to skirt over that 1 year. So John got captured at Fort St. John, which is just south of Montreal, and marched with the other 1,500 or so prisoners that Americans had sort of scooped up as a result of two forts that they had captured, down into the designated area for where these prisoners were going to be held. Not in captivity, they were going to be under house arrest, with a 6-mile radius that they could in a sense, sort of explore beyond the house that they would be nominated to live. They were going to go to Pennsylvania, so Lancaster, Reading, and by extension, Carlisle. When they got too difficult to handle in Lancaster and Reading, they were shipped off to Carlisle, which was fairly remote, it was almost on the border. And there's John's life stopped in war terms for about a year, but it didn't stop for him, and it didn't stop for Americans.
Right.
Okay. Firstly, they had to take care of the prisoners, and there's a lot of information about that in some very good collections put together by the Americans of that period, but it doesn't appear in the biographies because I'm just not sure people would be interested. Other biographers say about him a year in captivity, but for me it was very important to understand the tensions between Americans and Britons away from the battlefield, and there were tensions, partly because a lot of the towns that they were coming to weren't ready for 500 prisoners to be offloaded onto them and told you've got to pay for them, you've got to house them, so there were issues like that, and Britons didn't like being put into captivity; they weren't used to that.
Well, there's also the dynamic of the fact that many of these small towns were not full of patriots. They still had loyalists, and that you had to worry about the relationship between the prisoners and the loyalists. And I mean, that's again another thing that most of us forget when we learn about the Revolution, is that you like to think of it as everybody rising up together. I think it's like only half of the American population, or the colonial population, actually wanted independence. About half wanted to remain loyal to the crown. And so you have those people everywhere.
Yeah,
you have to worry about.
I think you're very indulgent to the British on that point there. I think if we're talking about 50-50, I think candidly my view is the majority really did want to move on with their lives, and independence was the way to go. But there was a significant minority, a lot of them in quite powerful positions, who were very ambivalent about independence, were forced to be silent about the process, and hoped that the British would do something to break the impasse that was building up, leading to war, and now into war. But the British just didn't deliver. They didn't bring enough troops. Right. They didn't enough support, and left a lot of the loyalists basically abandoned, forced to go silent. So, as you say, there was a lot of tension there at the civilian level, and John, probably his greatest quality above all was his ability to be invisible. He learned that he was handsome, but he could be a bit of a chameleon. So whilst he was in that year of captivity, he was making friends,
right,
in very innocent ways, through his poetry, through his artistry. He was a great little painter. So he would sketch the sons of so and so, and that way he would become friendly. You might use the word ingratiate. That's a negative connotation. He wanted to win the Americans back to the British cause. He did not hate Americans. In fact, he liked a lot of Americans. He wanted to be a good ambassador.
One thing I found interesting is he really misses the year of the war that went best for the British. 1776, Americans look at this as kind of like our year. But that was not a good year for the Continental Army. That was lose New York Colony, the most important colony, get pushed back almost out of Philadelphia, and later lose Philadelphia. Washington, I've seen some of the letters Washington writes to some of his relatives at the end of 76, basically saying, I think we're going to lose this thing. Like, I think the war is close to being lost. Of course, 1777, when Andre is released, is a much better year for the colonists, at least toward the end of it. So when Andre comes back, you're looking at everything from the kind of the move across the Delaware, across the Delaware River to Valley Forge, from Valley Forge to attack the Hessians to Saratoga at kind of the end of the year. So he's really reintroduced when things aren't going great for the British. And certainly 78 is when the war is essentially going to be over one way or another. You can kind of, in hindsight, look at that.
Yeah, it's interesting because, in a sense, you've got two theaters of war going on in that in that year, 1777. You've got the Philadelphia campaign, and you've got the campaign to come down from Canada, down effectively the Hudson Channel, okay, and link up with New York and cut off the super rebellious New England colonies. So the plan there was to divide, mm-hmm. okay. And that's Burgoyne coming down from Canada, but he fails.
Right.
Gets caught at Saratoga. But whilst he's failing at Saratoga, the British are succeeding at Philadelphia. And you know, literally, the British arrived at the gates of Philadelphia at the same time that Saratoga is being, the Battle of Saratoga is going on and being lost by the British. So there was definitely a schizophrenic reaction by the British. But John was in the winning team.
Right.
He was with General Howe, marching his way up to Philadelphia, and this is where, in addition to Fort St. John a year before, he was blooding himself. So, yes, he was a spy. Fast forward, but actually at this stage, he is a battle-hardened, and soon to be battle-hardened officer fighting alongside somebody called General Gray. Now, he's an iconic figure, along with Prescott. Mm-hmm. For American propaganda. Why I keep on coming back to propaganda? Because my doctorate was about propaganda.
Right, no.
Okay.
Well, all Americans understand the value of propaganda in the Revolution from Thomas Paine and Sons of Liberty.
There's truth there, and there's whatever it is. Okay, yeah. But you can make a lot more of truth by adding a bit of propaganda, as long as there's truth somewhere in the core there. And there was a battle. Battle of Paoli, is that how you pronounce it? Paoli, yeah. Or it's the massacre of Paoli, okay? And this was when the British under Grey decided to take the bullets out of their guns and fix their bayonets. Now, I have to be careful what I say here, okay? Because if I compare that to the later massacre, Baylor's Massacre, which is also another infamous incident that Grey was involved in, that was unpardonable, the Baylor one, because he took, this is a year or so later, Gray took American soldiers and officers by surprise who were just camping out, mm-hmm. and massacred them at the end of a bayonet. The difference with Paoli was intelligence had come to Gray, probably via John, that General Wayne was planning an ambush the following morning, early morning. So Gray decided to preempt that and do a night attack. And a night attack, you don't go in with guns blazing because you're going, sadly, for better or worse, with bayonets.
Right. I mean, it's a covert action. You want to try to go in
absolutely,
silently.
Okay. So I'm standing my ground on that, making two comparisons there, because one, it was appalling. The other one was in the laws of war, unnecessary.
But it was tactically necessary. I mean, go in silently. I mean,
exactly. Okay. So, but John was in the thick of that. He wrote up. He was writing a journal because Gray wanted him to keep a daily journal of Gray's successes and and brackets failures. So John's job was to keep a record, but that record required him to go out into the field. Mm-hmm. Behind enemy lines, because it was also his job as a sort of quartermaster was to forage, because the 20,000 people had arrived for this campaign on Philadelphia, and they had to be fed, mm-hmm. and all that. So we weren't going to plunder, we were going to forage. The Hessians unfortunately plundered. The British were told, well, the Hessians were told as well, but they ignored the orders. The British were told, you do not plunder, because we want to win over the civilian population.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
I want to, if you set the scene for us in 1778 of the wonderful deception operation that John runs using the women in Philadelphia.
Yep.
Can you set the scene and kind of walk through that story? Because I don't even want to lead you up to it. It's a wonderful story. It comes back to be important later on, certainly because of the relationships that are built during this time also.
Exactly. Yeah, to refresh memories, Britain had recaptured Philadelphia in late 1777. And they were occupying Philadelphia through the winter, through till about May, June of the following year. And it was a poison chalice. They were trapped in Philadelphia. It was a valley forge over the horizon. The Americans were building up an army, and basically Saratoga had happened. Suddenly, a war is now pretty much over.
Was the French, after Saratoga, joined the war?
Exactly. And, yeah. So we're in a trap. In Philadelphia, had a nice winter, whereas the Americans at Valley Forge have been freezing. More importantly than that, how are we going to get out? Because orders had come now that we've got to retreat to New York, which was still firm base. How do you move well on some 20,000 people? And plus loyalists who had hung their coats on the British success and suddenly were being abandoned. Mm-hmm. They're going to want to leave as well, people like Joseph Galloway. So the British had to plan that exit. But Howe was also being recalled at that time. And a lot of the officers serving under Howe were very loyal to him. And they were unhappy that he was being recalled, apparently in disgrace. So this thing called the Meschianza, which is basically a sort of, almost a medieval, entertainment stroke banquet, was put together by a group of officers, among whom was John. He brought his skills as a poet and artist to the preparation for the entertainment, because they were going to be putting on a play. There was going to be a sort of theatrical with women, loyalist women, young ladies dressed in Turkish style, which was all the fashion at that time. So John drew images of what the girls were going to have to wear, so they all went away and got the seamstress to make their dresses for them. What John was doing was preparing for the departure. He understood where this was going, but he was building his relationships with the women, trying to work out who in amongst the dozen or so women who had volunteered to be part of the Meschianza, who were going to be loyal friends once the British had left.
Basically, who were going to be stay-behinds, who are going to not leave with the rest of the loyalists, and who are going to be left in place.
As a fifth column.
Right.
In modern-day language. So he looked down the list, obviously formed relationships with various of the girls, and he homed in on, for want of a better expression, on a young girl called Peggy Shippen, who was 17, probably going on 18, who was the daughter of one of the daughters of the Chief Justice of Shippen of Philadelphia, a loyalist who was trying to keep his feet in two camps. But Peggy had no illusions about that. She knew exactly where her loyalties were in her mind. The British were going to be retreating, but they were going to be coming back. This was a war that Britain was going to win. So they cut a deal and agreed that Peggy was going to form a relationship with a senior Continental Army officer, so far unchosen, and marry him. and turn him.
Right. So we'll talk about who that's going to be in a second. I mentioned that there's been a lot of back and forth, and there's a lot of disagreement about what Andre's relationship with Shippen was. If it was platonic, if it was professional, or if there was actually a romantic relationship.
Yeah.
Where do you come down on that?
In my opinion, it was a relationship of convenience to a certain in the beginning, based on common goals and common interests and common sympathies. I have great difficulty imagining a girl of 17 would allow herself to be deflowered,
right,
for want of a better word to describe her, by a man who she wants to trust but is about to leave town. Okay, may or may not succeed, and she doesn't need, they do not need to form that relationship. There's enough of a relationship as it is. There may be a marriage at some stage that will be the reward for both of them, mm-hmm, when they've both succeeded. They don't need to muddy the waters at this, right, stage, because she needs to be able to deliver herself, excuse my vernacular there, to the Continental Army officer intact.
Right.
So I do not believe that, but I believe that there was love was formed, and it's evident from the intensity of some of the poems he subsequently wrote that love turned into a jealousy as we move forward into the plot.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, let's move forward into the plot, because of course we are talking about the recruitment of none other than Benedict Arnold.
Yeah.
Who, man, I think I was 5 years old or 6 years old in elementary school. We first hear that name as like the worst of the worst, the guy we hiss at. And I've read a lot about him, but you really, it's hard not to read this and just be like, God, this guy was a horrendous person.
Yeah.
Yeah, he comes back from being a fairly good general. I mean, he's one of the top generals, at least of success, in the Continental Army. And he gets injured and he comes back and wants to retire in Philadelphia, convenient for everyone. But he expected praise and stature and money and to be taken care of in Philadelphia, yeah, and found just none of it.
Yeah.
So Shippen clearly has a perfect target.
Exactly.
For moving forward.
And what I find interesting is that earlier biographies are ambivalent about the strength of Peggy's role in that those early stages of the plot. She was a driving force, no question about it. She and Benedict married in April 1779, and within 2 months, he was writing to Britain, to the British spy service in New York, saying, "I want to turn." Okay, so he was obviously ready to be turned, mm-hmm, but she unlocked the door.
Right.
Okay, so that's a very forceful woman in an age when women were frankly not that forceful, certainly not in a wartime period. So, you know, I found that fascinating. But Benedict Arnold was, again, I come back to the previous biographies, because Americans have been taught to hate Arnold as the ultimate turncoat, the story that's told about the ongoing plot now focuses on, slightly in my opinion, too much on how bad he was to Americans.
Right.
And I accept that, take it on face value, and I totally agree with it. That's not the issue. I'm not looking to rewrite that history. What I'm saying that, looking from a British point of view, is what he did to one Briton,
exactly,
was almost as bad, if not worse, because it's one thing to betray a country, heck, we don't want to happen to, but to betray a fellow blood brother in a plot, which is what he did.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. I was going to ask you that question. To you, there seems to be no question that Arnold sets Andre up.
When he started to is debatable, but at some point in time, so we're into a 18-month negotiation with Arnold and Peggy in Philadelphia and John now in New York, which is British headquarters, moving up the ranks to become the spy master.
Right.
The contact comes in, engineered by Peggy from Benedict, saying, "I want a turn." And there's an 18-month or so negotiation, which increasingly distills for the British down to what the grand stroke is going to be that's going to turn the war. And now we're not talking about turning the war so Britain would win it.
just so they can negotiate something.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Or maybe divide the colonies. Some master stroke, okay, which gets ever smaller and smaller as the American army becomes ever more all enveloping. Okay, so you can feel the claustrophobia in New York in the British camp there as they're running out of ideas, and John brings this idea to Clinton, who's the new commander in chief. Yeah, I've got a contact with a top general here. So for 18 months, they're negotiating with Clinton, with Arnold, over what the grand stroke is going to be, and it's constantly master stroke, grand stroke in these letters. It's all stagecraft, it's all spycraft. You've got coded letters,
right.
You've got invisible ink, the whole shooting match and code names.
Well, there's really great tradecraft on the part of Arnold, because at first he's not necessarily 100% sure Arnold is above board. He's worried, we call it a dangle, that Arnold was being sent by Washington to be a false traitor,
yep,
and to push disinformation. And then even the kind of negotiations about where they're going to meet and how they're going to get together, Andre's using good tradecraft. He doesn't want to find himself in a position where he's going to get caught. But Benedict Arnold really hits him where it hurts in the end, where he goes after his honor. He says he's cowardly for not doing it the way he wants to do. And then, of course, uses Peggy Shippen as bait.
Exactly. What is interesting is that whilst the British are talking about this, the basis of the master stroke, which ultimately fixes on West Point, Arnold is thinking about one thing and one thing only at that stage. How many shekels am I going to get? How many 30 pieces of silver,
right,
am I
exactly
going to get? He's driven by money, money, money. And he's saying, I want the money, whether I succeed or whether I fail. Now, the British want to pay him because the British want to be turning generals. So they're not averse to paying him. They don't want to pay him for failure. They want to pay him for success. So there's this argy-bargy that goes on between by remote control through all the coded letters and, mm-hmm, secret agents and passing through various loyalist intermediaries. There's the negotiation carries on. It fails. Britain then says, okay, forget about Arnold. We're going to go off and we'll attack Charleston. So a mission goes down to Charleston. So the negotiations are interrupted for 6 months or so. And now we're back into early 1780 when John comes back from Charleston, the successful capture of Charleston, which was a major victory for the British.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Clinton then comes back. And coincidentally, Arnold resuscitates the failed negotiations. By which time, Peggy is pregnant and pretty much out of the game. Okay, so as active as she was in the beginning, she's now fairly passive and invisible. Arnold is now negotiating direct. It's no longer letters that Arnold composes for Peggy to write to John.
Right.
Peggy's out of the game. Okay, but she's there to be used as bait. Pick up on your earlier point. So negotiations resuscitated, and now Arnold is moving at cracking pace. He's just negotiated with Washington to be made commandant of West Point. West Point was important then because it was up this vital waterway called the Hudson River.
Right.
Control of that could divide the 13 colonies, which was now the fallback position for British military policy. Control that waterway all the way up to Montreal, and we could just about divide the New England colonies and therefore have an honorable peace. So West Point is the target. That's the grand stroke. And Arnold's got himself, he's finagled Washington into agreeing with him to make him commandant. So now Arnold's in pole position to deliver up this grand stroke. But he's now moved on emotionally. Whether it's because he's heard back in Philadelphia from all these other belles, not just Peggy, how handsome and dashing and lovable and romantic and et cetera, and glamorous this chappie called John Andre was during the occupation. So John is handsome, 30-year-old. Arnold is war-wounded, crippled, past his sell-by date in today's modern language. So I feel that a jealousy built up. So it was no longer just about money, it was about jealousy.
Right.
Okay. But he wasn't going to let that get control of him, because actually it suited his plan. If he could get John behind American lines, cut a deal with him in secret about the 30 pieces of silver, then dump John, okay, leave him behind, to live or die, preferably to die, when Arnold arrived in British headquarters, because Arnold was pretty certain that the West Point conspiracy, the West Point deal was a no-hoper. The British believed in it, but he didn't believe in it. So what he was looking to do was he was looking to escape, okay, and to flee to America, to British lines, armed with a promise from John to honour the 30 pieces. Okay, that meant that John must not live.
Yeah.
To say, I didn't agree anything, because there's absolutely no way John was going to agree in the dead of night in this meeting that's happened and was engineered by Arnold, okay, at Haverstraw Bay in the upper reaches of the Hudson River. There's no way John was going to risk his professional career by agreeing something that had been under negotiation and disagreed with by Clinton for 2 years. Okay. He was not going to say, yeah, we'll pay you 31 pieces.
Right, so the idea was to draw Nitin, kind of waste a lot of time with him,
yep,
so that it becomes daylight and it's more difficult to, yep, escape, and then hope he gets killed so that he can go back and make up anything that he wants to, yep, when he talks to the British. Yep.
And now, this is where I diverge from the normal American versions of this story. I diverge simply because, in my opinion, American historians and biographers see John as a naive,
right,
because he failed, okay, and therefore failure automatically means that you were a bit of a naive, a bit of a sort of an ingenue. John's mistake, and in that sense I agree with American biographers, but for different reasons, John's mistake, he could not believe the evil that Benedict Arnold was capable of,
yeah,
that he was prepared to set him up to deliberately leave him behind American lines to take care of himself. But John actually writes in, I was betrayed.
Well, there's an extraordinary string of bad luck that Andre has. Running into Ben Talmadge, the head of American intelligence, when he's captured, is about as bad luck as you can get. Because if they had kind of passed him around a little bit, you know, not really knowing what to do with him, but he runs into Benjamin Talmadge, who brings him straight down to Washington, and that basically seals his fate in many respects.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I see Talmadge in a sense as just the final nail in the coffin, yeah, which has started from the moment that John came ashore 2 or 3 days later up at Haverstraw Bay, and had to go north, cross the Hudson, and come down south, down east of the Hudson, where he ran into the Skinners, was captured, and passed back to American lines because he had value with his boots and his shoes and all that sort of stuff. Okay,
right.
And interrogated by one American Continental Army officer, and then by Talmadge. But by the time he reached Talmadge, without disagreeing with you entirely, I felt the die was already cast. And
right,
actually, John, by that stage, had already decided that the die was cast.
Well, that's the interesting thing, is even in capture, he tried to be honorable. And that kind of is this kind of, yep, constant theme, to protect Peggy,
yep,
from making sure that she doesn't get drawn into this, even though she was knee-deep in it. Even to protect Benedict Arnold, but a lot of that was to protect Peggy, because obviously Arnold goes track straight back to, yep, her. And really, what he's trying to push is to prevent the British from falling into a trap. So he's trying to get this information out,
yeah,
so that even in death, he can keep them from a, you know, final death blow.
Yeah. I mean, he did not have a death wish as such, you know, and right up until the end, he probably thought that, you know, there's a possibility I might be exchanged. I'm an officer. But he accepted that more important than his life and his death now at this stage was the 241, as you say, protect Peggy. Now, why did he need to protect Peggy? Why was she vulnerable? Why she was vulnerable? Because if John spilled the beans on Arnold before Arnold could escape, there was the risk that Arnold would spill the beans on his wife.
Wait, he clearly has no honor at all.
Exactly.
He's probably going to sing like a
canary. So the devil's pact that was effectively made by John, probably in those negotiations that went so seriously pear-shaped over in Haverstraw Bay, was, we three are in this together, aren't we? Mm-hmm. And that would have been a message to John, if you put a foot wrong now, as I'm about to abandon you, yeah, you can bring me down, you can bring yourself down, but are you prepared to bring down Peggy? Because if we, the two of us, bring down Peggy, she will be hanged. And you, Americans may not hang women, but this may be a first.
Oh, yeah. This, in essence, this is a love story to a degree. I mean, yeah. You have to look at this as, I kind of read this thinking A Tale of Two Cities. You know, the idea of kind of giving your life for the woman you love,
yeah.
even though she's with another guy and all this. So yeah. where Andre has the chance to fry Arnold and decides not to because it could possibly hurt Peggy.
Yeah.
And it's really, I mean, honor, you can use whatever word you want, but that's a love story
yeah,
in my respect.
Yeah. And what an interesting point in those latter days of the story before he reaches Talmadge, okay, but Talmadge sees, you know, exactly where it's coming from, is these maps, the maps of West Point. Again, American authors, biographers have said, this has to prove his naivety, that he actually held on to these maps, put them into his boots. So when he was captured, here is, you know, in flagrante evidence. Therefore, you know, ergo, he was a complete naive, did not understand spycraft. Throw it into the water, get rid right. of the maps. My argument is it's exactly the opposite. He had to hold on to the maps because he had to prove back to headquarters, if he got back to headquarters, or if he didn't get back to headquarters and somehow Arnold managed to swing this West Point conspiracy, okay, that the maps were proof positive that Arnold was betraying the British.
Because the maps were crap, right? They weren't, you know, and you explain this in the book, based on his time as essentially an imagery analyst, is what we kind of look at today, yeah. of drawing maps and understanding, and all you have to do is look at them and go, that's not right.
Exactly. He didn't need to hold on to the maps because he had a brilliant memory. He'd been working with maps, as you say, for many years. So he didn't have to take them with him, but he chose to take them with him
as proof that
Arnold was drawing them into a trap. Not a trap for the benefit of a Washington, okay, but into a trap, okay? And that actually Arnold had no intention of seeing that through. He was looking to get across the British lines as quickly as he could and collect his 31 pieces of silver.
Get paid. So one last thing. I'm wondering about how real you think the Alexander Hamilton trade offer was and how that could have potentially made history a little different.
I think it's spot on. I think it's typical of the deniability. We see it with politicians nowadays. The president can't, you know, a president can't say something, but he can gainsay his junior,
right.
who does say something. Okay, and how far you go down to the junior is a matter for debate. But in this case, I think Americans, and this is again part of the problem with Americans writing about this, they're driven by a sense of guilt about the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to hang Arnold.
Right, no one wanted to hang John.
But they had to hang Andre. They had to do something.
Right.
Because you had Congress breathing down Washington's neck saying, we've got to have some punishment here.
Right.
So the Hamilton story is very believable because I think Washington was looking for a way out. But he couldn't, you know, officially do that. So he said to Hamilton, look, let's see if we can sow a seed here with the British that there's a trade-off to be done here. And Clinton, from all he wrote later, that's the commander-in-chief down in New York, from all I've read about him afterwards, he would love to have done it.
Right, everyone thought this was a great idea, except for the fact that it just couldn't happen.
You
right?
could not trade blood.
Yeah.
As bad as the situation was here, we knew the Americans wanted out of this situation. Clinton would have dearly loved to have given him Arnold at some point in time. But at that point in time, if you start handing back a traitor, a turncoat, okay, whatever you like to call it, no other turncoats will ever come across,
right.
ever, again.
You got to protect your assets.
Okay, so he had to hold on to Arnold, but Arnold had a very bad time with the British. The other British officers would not work with him because they didn't trust him.
There is a wonderful kind of nice ending to all the wretched miscreant kind of perception of, even going into Britain, no one liked him, no one...
Yeah.
Well, trust a traitor, right?
But look at it from Washington's point of view. He said, hey, he's no longer our problem.
Yeah.
You know, the British can have him. But that's diverting us away from the sad story, which is John. Yes, I'm not looking to rewrite history on this one or sort of change the outcome or the emphasis here about the fact that John needed to die, deserved to die. He was found as a spy. And part of his... that process, well, after you've been captured and brought to Washington by Talmadge, was to ensure that he was found guilty and executed as quickly as possible. Why? Because the British needed to know very quickly indeed that the plot had failed.
Right.
So that was his final sacrifice, not only to protect Peggy, but also to hasten his death. So he got the wheels moving quickly to ensure that there was an end game more rapidly. You know, a long negotiation, a long trial.
Right.
You know, witnesses called, and gradually the full truth about, among others, Peggy coming out, just get on with it.
So the book is The Life of John Andre, the Redcoat Who Turned Benedict Arnold. The author is Dr. Doug Ronald. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here on SpyCast. I've been waiting for this. This book came out in, I think, January. So it's been, when is he coming to the United States? So really appreciate the conversation, because this is an interesting figure in not only British history, but also American history. Yeah. So it's great to have you here.
And thank you for the time.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit. If you want to donate to the museum, or if you're local and want to volunteer at the museum, please visit our website at spymuseum.org for more information.